From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Boredom is the loss of the capacity to wonder, to appreciate the sense of mystery and awe in life.
Warning, boredom may be hazardous to your health.
If we don't do anything about it, then we're doomed to bore ourselves to death.
In case you haven't figured it out yet, we're going to take an exciting look at boredom in this hour.
When you're bored, it's really, really hard to imagine that life was ever different or that life could ever be different.
And doing nothing, a history of loafers, loungers, slackers, and bums in America. But first, let's begin our exploration of boredom with the philosophy of boredom. It's the title of a book by Lars Svensson. Svensson teaches philosophy at the University of Bergen in Norway. He told Anne Strangechamps that boredom has a long, long history.
I think that some varieties of boredom has been around as long as there has been men on this earth. If you, for instance, read the Ecclesiastes, it starts with everything is emptiness or vanity, depending on the translation. Then you can read Seneca, the Roman philosopher, writes about the tedium vita, the tiredness of life. But a striking thing is that up until about the late 18th century, boredom seemed to be a pretty marginal phenomenon reserved for priests, nobility, and so on. And what happened was that boredom was democratized. Suddenly it became available to all of us. And that's around the same time that boredom also stopped being a status symbol. I mean, before that, one could actually brag about being bored. But as boredom became available to the masses as well, it was no longer much to brag about.
So when did this happen? When was the word boredom actually coined?
The English word boredom is found at the earliest in the 1760s. The German Langeweile is from approximately the same time. Actually, the Norwegian Kjedsomhet is a little bit earlier, so maybe we started getting really bored a little bit earlier. It's very striking that all these words for boredom in different languages pop up at approximately the same time. There's definitely been some sort of major cultural shift around that time.
Well, what was happening then?
There are lots of economic changes. You get a middle class starts to develop. Religion no longer has as much of a grip on people. And of course, religion is a tremendously important source of meaning. So I think there are lots of different cultural changes that come together and produce boredom. And of course, the emergence of individuality is very, very important development here.
Wasn't this also about the time that the very, very first beginnings of the Industrial Revolution were coming about, the invention of the steam engine, the spinning jenny? Does that have something to do with our discovery of boredom or the spread of boredom?
I think so. Of course, if I should go a little bit Marxist here, I mean, one could use a word such as alienation, people becoming alienated from work and so on. But I actually think that the emergence of individualism is much more important, because what happens then is that all these former collective sources of meaning, I mean, they get diminished in importance. And then each one of us has to find some sort of meaning for ourselves. And that's pretty tricky. So I think that's probably the main explanation for the emergence of the really deep existential form of boredom that's actually pretty closely related to depression.
You know, I realize we've been talking about boredom and assuming that we mean the same thing, but in fact, boredom can mean really many different things, can't it? And there must be different types of boredom.
Yeah, sure. There are varieties of boredom. One pretty obvious form of boredom is what I call situative boredom, where something specific in a situation or the lack of something specific in a situation is boring. For instance, if one listens to a dreadfully boring, long-winded lecture, I mean, that can be hell on earth. Or if you stay at an airport and your flight is delayed and so on, we all know that. Another form of boredom is what one could perhaps call repetitive boredom, in which something that's really nice in itself, gets boring due to the sheer amount of repetition. For instance, eating at, say, Gordon Ramsay's restaurant for a night, I mean, that's wonderful. Eating there 365 days a year would be dreadful.
Mm. A vacation on the beach is wonderful for a week, but if you had to do nothing but stay on the beach for a month, you might get bored.
Yeah. And then there's the deep existential boredom where the soul is empty, the world is empty. That's a variety of boredom that's very closely related to depression. And then there's creative boredom, which is not characterized so much by its contents as by the fact that it actually forces you to do something. I guess one could describe my book on boredom as a result of creative boredom.
So it sounds like that's the state we all need to strive for, creative boredom. But that's really a response to boredom, not boredom
itself.
Yeah, I had
to figure out, because it's a terrible state to be in when it really digs in deep. So we do all sorts of crazy things to try to get out of it.
So how would you describe the feeling of boredom? I mean, we all talk about it. We all think we know what it is. And yet, what is it?
One could perhaps describe it metaphorically as if eternity has entered this world. I mean, you're stuck in a now, an instant that's empty and seems to have absolutely no end whatsoever. And that would be one way to describe it. Another way to describe boredom would be to say that it's actually a lack of personal meaning. I think that comes close to something, because often one can hear that, well, if you're bored, you haven't got enough to do. I think that's plain wrong. I mean, you can have so much to do. You can work like insane and still be so bored with what you're doing because you simply find no personal meaning in it. So the question of boredom is a question of meaning, not a question of having much to do or little to do.
Do you think it's our own fault when we're bored? I mean, do you think, is boredom a choice?
Emotions generally seem to be something that happens to us, not something we choose. On the other hand, we are responsible for what sort of situations we place ourselves in. And in that sense, one is also responsible for one's own boredom. The next responsibility is, well, how am I going to relate to this boredom? That's definitely my responsibility. And I think that the worst approach is to make one's entire life a constant flight away from boredom. Because that means letting boredom dictate, in effect, one's entire life. I think that a much better approach is actually to see boredom as some sort of voice of conscience, as an emotion that tells you something about the way you live your life. And if you, in boredom, feel that your life has become almost nothing, maybe that's because you live your life in such a way as a nothing. And maybe that's a wake-up call to take a different approach to what you do in life. And in that sense, I think that Nietzsche is absolutely correct when he says that whoever shields himself completely off from boredom also shields himself completely off from himself. I think boredom is actually a source of knowledge of oneself and one's life.
So there are some benefits to boredom. It's not just a very unpleasant state.
Another interesting thing that I discovered is that in research on boredom, a common finding is that men complain a lot more about boredom than women. And I wondered, why on earth should that be the case?
Do men just complain about it more?
Well, I mean, it's hard to distinguish between someone complaining about it and really feeling it, but we can see that definitely more men than women report that boredom is a significant factor in their life. And I thought about it for a while, and what I ended up with might be wrong. It's a really simple solution, because in research on depression, a lot more women than men report being depressed. Mm-hmm. So it might just be that what one gender describes as depression more or less is the same as what the other gender describes as boredom.
It's interesting. We just use different words.
Yeah, that might be the case. It's my most promising hypothesis so far.
I'm wondering if there's, is there any significance to the fact that we use different words? I mean, what does it say to you that women describe the same state as depression and men describe it as boredom?
It's hard to tell why that should be the case. It might be that men are brought up to a greater extent to be sort of active, constantly engaged in sports and something.
Well, you know what it makes me think is, when you complain that you're bored, you're sort of complaining about the world outside. You know, I'm bored,
yeah.
Which says, amuse yeah. me, you know, or something outside yeah. is not right. But if you say I'm depressed, that's complaining about an internal state. So it sort of suggests men are kind of more likely to blame their unpleasant feelings on something happening outside of them, and women are more likely to blame themselves.
Yeah, that might be the case, yeah.
Anyway.
I see that.
So if a great deal of our current Western culture involves a flight from boredom with, you know, a constant ramping up of stimulation and novelty in an attempt to escape the feeling of being bored, what would life be like if we turned around instead and embraced boredom? What would that look like? What would we do?
Well, I think boredom is pretty hard to embrace. I think that rather than embrace boredom, I'd say that one should accept boredom. Accept the fact that boredom is a factor in one's life. But it's only one factor among many. And by taking that sort of approach, boredom no longer becomes this big, scary thing that one has to spend one's entire life fleeing away from. But it simply becomes one factor among many others. That doesn't solve the problem of boredom, but it changes the character of the problem, at least.
So in some ways, we simply need to learn to become more resilient.
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that probably one of the worst things one can do when bringing up children is to keep them stimulated at all times. Because I think that if you're going to have a fairly livable life, you have to be able to learn yourself to live with boredom. I'm trying to learn it myself, but I have extremely low thresholds for boredom.
Lars Svensson is the author of A Philosophy of Boredom. He spoke with Anstrain Champs. John Winokur has compiled and edited a book called Ennui to Go, The Art of Boredom. And we thought it would be interesting to combine some of the famous quotes about boredom from the book with a few songs about boredom. So we did, and here it is.
Boredom is the malaise of our civilization, with its relatively large amounts of leisure time, and this sickness is manifested both in the widespread of acute boredom and in the frantic activities to escape boredom.
The two enemies of human happiness are pain and boredom.
Boredom is like the pitiless zooming in on the epidermis of time. Every instant is dilated, magnified like the pores of the face.
The poor get bored, the rich have ennui.
Boredom is relative. One can find great joy and fulfillment in a long afternoon of port sitting. One can be bored at the task of skydiving or rock climbing. It's what is in the mind that counts.
Boredom can be very useful, say its friends. Great inventions have come along because the inventor was bored with his life, casting about for solutions. Romances have resulted because young lovers had experienced boredom with somebody less interesting and were driven to link up with a non-boring person.
Boredom depends on the nothingness that pervades reality. that causes a dizziness like that produced by looking down into a yawning chasm.
I'm bored. I'm the chairman of the board. I'm sick and I go to sleep at night. I'm still sick in the broad daylight, 'cause I'm bored.
Poor get bored, the rich have ennui.
That's our Ode to Boredom, inspired by the book Ennui to Go, The Art of Boredom. John Winokur compiled and edited the book. Gita Schwartz found herself suffering from a severe case of boredom a while back, and her father was even more bored as he neared death. Schwartz wrote an essay about their experiences. It's called A Case of Boredom, and it appears in the February issue of The Believer magazine. Here's Gita Schwartz with the opening paragraphs from her essay.
Some time ago, I discovered boredom. Or rather, boredom discovered me, moving into my body like a happy parasite. Soon boredom took over everything, ate at every action and activity, reading, talking, eating, even sleeping. There was no knock at the door, boredom has arrived. Instead, I noticed one day that nothing seemed worth saying. Not I love you, not I'm tired, not time to get up. In my dreams, there was silence. I was bored in sleep. I'd know I was bored in sleep because I'd wake up and have no energy to remember a dream. Before sitting up to turn off the alarm, I'd remember that I was bored, that there was no reason to wash and dress. For a few minutes, my sense of obligation, go to work, you have so much work, would battle my desire to stop moving, and the internal struggle itself would provide enough fuel to get me to the coffee machine, to the shower, to my toothbrush, clothes, comb, shoes. I'd start feeling bored again as soon as I touched my coat. Outside, I would look at the street and the school children hopping along with their harried parents, forget the boredom for a second, and then remember again as I went down the steps and walked to the tree-lined corner of my subway station. I would wait on the platform, then find a seat on the always empty G line, the only line that never touches the island of Manhattan. I knew that fact from when everything about my neighborhood and my job and my life was exciting. On the train, I would hope I could take out my book from my messenger bag. If I managed it, if I decided to read rather than stare at the other passengers and contemplate my boredom, if I entered a different world during the half-hour commute, I'd have a better day. If not, I would sit and look at the others, amazed that they weren't screaming from boredom.
Gita Schwartz reading an excerpt from her essay, A Case of Boredom. What inspired Schwartz to write about her battle with boredom?
Well, it's funny to use the word inspiration because I was inspired to write it because I had an incredibly deep, profound case of existential boredom. I was just terribly, terribly bored. And I couldn't stop talking about how bored I was. And one day I mentioned it to a friend and she actually asked me if I had read anything about it. And once I started to read about it, I felt sort of unsatisfied with what I was reading. And it made me start writing about it. And that in and of itself helped me not just understand the boredom, but actually get through it in some way.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I mean, you write in the article that as bored as you were, your father was more bored still as he struggled toward death. Can you explain that to me?
My father died a very, very, very long, slow death. And he actually was somebody who had an incredible capacity to not be bored. When we were kids, he could actually spend an enormous amount of time just watching me and my sister watch television. He found that fascinating. It made him happy. He did not find that boring at all. But he'd had a lot of trauma in his life, and I think he understood escaping from death and surviving as not boring in a lot of ways. And the way that he was dying was just against everything he had gone through. He was getting weaker and weaker and weaker, wasting away and just waiting to die. And it was the first time he had ever experienced that. Even when he had been very, very sick before, he had really conceived of himself as being able to survive anything. There was really quite a change in him. It was really the first time any of us had ever seen him bored and wishing it were over. And when is it going to be over? When is it going to be over? When is it going to end? In the way that even, you know, a little kid might say in the car, are we there yet? It was quite an amazing experience. And also, when anybody dies, it's really the loneliest, most isolated feeling. No one can understand what that feeling is when you're dying and when you know you are dying.
Yeah. Kirst, you describe him as a man who can survive anything, but when what you're trying to survive is the end of survival, it's hard to see how to get through it.
And it's very hard to sort of conceptualize that when you've lived your whole life thinking you're this miraculous case that somehow got through all these terrible things, and you're dying in the most banal, awful way, just sickening in your bed and waiting.
You also talk about it as being related to loneliness. Is there a relationship between boredom and loneliness?
For me, there definitely was. I definitely think that was the case for my father. One of the things about boredom is that you feel that no one can really understand what you're going through. Everyone else seems very interested in what they're doing, or at least not dissatisfied. And you are sitting here with a case of incredible frustration that no one understands how deeply boring the waiting and the lack of a future is. And one of the things about boredom, you think about it as being bored with what you're hearing or what you're understanding from the world. But I think a lot of it is that you feel that no one can understand you, and that's related to loneliness in a very deep way.
Yeah. The other thing that's fascinating, you in the article you write that boredom is the enemy of a healthy concept of time. It's essentially all in the present. There's no future, there's no past. It's just now, and now isn't very good.
Well, you know, I think of it as sort of this sick, perverted version of love. You know, when you're in love, you cannot imagine not being in love. You can't remember what it was like to feel, you know, just regular about everything and not happy. And when you're bored, it's really, really hard to imagine that life was ever different or that life could ever be different. I think a lot of a certain kind of boredom is not about the activities you're doing. It's not about the work you're doing or the people you're talking to. It's about not being able to see a different way of experiencing those same activities. Mm. And it always seems to be endless. You can't imagine how it would possibly end.
How about for you? Did this essentially coincide with your father's last illness? I mean, when he died at home, did that have an effect on your boredom?
It really did. First of all, we were all very, it's a strange word to use, but we were all very happy that what he had wanted, which was to die at home, we were able to accomplish. And it didn't always seem like that was going to be possible. So we were very happy that we had given him his wish. And it seemed like such a difficult thing to do, and yet we did it. And that in and of itself felt like all that boredom had actually been actions toward a goal.
Worth it in a way.
Worth it in a way, yes. And the other thing is, as frequently happens when somebody that you are close to dies, you're surrounded by people who are, you know, telling you what a wonderful person your father was, and they're basically validating your feeling. And we talked a little bit earlier about how boredom is related to loneliness. Suddenly, it's the least lonely feeling in the world, grief. Dying is the most lonely feeling, but grief is really not that lonely if you have people around you to comfort you and to remind you what you are losing in a way. And that feeling really stayed with me for quite a while. The process of grieving was the process of sort of reconnecting with people and listening to their thoughts and hearing what they had to say, and everybody seems interested in what you have to say about your father and your experiences with him. So that was a major turning point.
That's sort of a positive thing about boredom then. I mean, there was something good that came out of it.
Well, I guess so. I mean, I do feel a little bit of criticism, or I don't know, the word that's coming to mind is resentment against a lot of the writers about boredom who do seem to think of it as sort of a fallow period and then you sort of rejuvenate, or it's sort of a period of rest because we're so overstimulated. I really did not experience it that way at all. I had tons of stuff to do all the time. I was dealing with tons of crisis in my professional life and my personal life with my dad. I didn't experience the boredom as this sort of positive resting place and then you come out of it with a really great feeling that you're new again. It was more that the boredom ended, and then I was happy.
Did you feel as though you ended the boredom, or did it leave of its own accord?
It left. I didn't do anything. Believe me, I tried plenty of methods of being on board, and I couldn't do it at all. And then one day it was just gone.
Gaita Schwartz is the author of the essay A Case of Boredom. It's published in the February issue of The Believer magazine. You can find a link to an excerpt from the Schwartz essay on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, why boredom can be hazardous to our health, and the fine art of doing nothing, as we continue to take a thrilling look at boredom. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. You might think that boredom is boring, but Agustín de la Peña thinks that boredom is fascinating. De la Peña is a psychophysiologist who works at a sleep disorders center in South Texas. His interest in boredom goes back to the early 1970s. De la Peña's written a treatise on boredom. It is almost 1,000 pages long. He told Steve Paulson that boredom's an important part of our lives.
I don't consider boredom to be trivial, which is the ordinary understanding of boredom or conception of boredom. That is, the average man on the street and most of our, I'd say 99% of the population, if you ask them their view of boredom, they'll say, well, it's a trivial matter. You can just brush it away by doing something. So it has no great consequence because I can always avoid it by turning on the TV or radio or reading a book or going to sleep or smoking a cigarette or having sex or whatever.
And yet there have been great thinkers in the past who have said that boredom had a profound influence on us. There was the 19th century philosopher Kierkegaard who called boredom the root of all evil. What's your take on that idea?
Well, evil, as you know, is a term that's pretty ambiguous and needs some definition. If by evil, let's suppose we can agree that evil refers to some wanton, psychopathic, aggressive, violent behavior that's injurious or that kills somebody, and that somebody is innocent and didn't provoke it, that might be a good starting point for a definition of evil. If Kierkegaard meant that by evil, I think Kierkegaard's statements is a little bit of an overstatement, a little bit of an oversimplification. Certainly not all evil, in that sense of the definition I just mentioned, is due to boredom. You know, there's hundreds of other factors that impact human behavior besides boredom.
But I guess the question is whether some evil results from boredom.
If by evil we mean wanton, psychopathic, destructive behavior, I don't have any doubt that that's true. You can see that in the newspapers every day where, you know, some teenager will be interviewed and he said, oh, I shot somebody just to have fun. I think peoples or societies or cultures wage war on other cultures or societies, not just for the fun of it, but to induce a little bit of interest and excitement. So I think boredom can even prime individuals and societies into wanton, aggressive, violent behavior.
So you're saying that nations sometimes go to war just because they're bored?
No. That's a huge over. I've never said that, and that's not in my book. That statement appeared in a national magazine where I was interviewed maybe 6 months ago. But I've never made that statement. What I'm trying to say is that when individuals or nations reach a certain level of cognitive sophistication, that leaves them in a low-intensity state that I equate with the experience of boredom, and that makes them more receptive, more interested in picking a fight, so to speak, simply to relieve boredom. There's no doubt that war galvanizes attention. You know, it focuses attention like few things do. Maybe sex is something equivalent to war. The French philosopher Sartre said that he would never felt more alive than when, as a member of the French Resistance, he was likely to be shot at any moment. So I think boredom primes us to pick a fight if, you know, in weighing the consequences of that fight, we decide we have a lot more to gain than to lose.
Hmm. So when you look back through history, are there any particular wars that you look at as, well, maybe that was instigated because the participants were just kind of bored?
Well, there's all sorts of references to such wars in history. I don't know if they're true or not, but certainly looking at the current war or any current war in the world, I think they're happening mainly among developed nations where the modal consciousness is such that, oh, yeah, I could stand a little bit more stimulation, a little bit more interest in my life. My life's a little routine. Having war is the ultimate adventure. I can tune in on the TV, and there's even these days journalists accompanying the soldiers, and I can get, you know, it's kind of like war is entertainment. I think entertainment right now is the biggest industry in the world.
Because it's a response to boredom? Isn't that what the entertainment industry is all about, trying to rev us up to allow us to escape being bored?
That's certainly my take on it, but I've never seen that in print, say in a scholarly formal document. But that's certainly my take. And see, I believe that over time, modal boredom, that is average levels of boredom in the population, at least in the Western adult population, is now at the highest point that it's ever been. But I don't think that short-term boredom is increasing because we have more and more tools, mainly technological tools to keep us entertained. You know, we didn't have cell phones a long time ago. We didn't have TV, radio, Blackberries, iPods, all these things that we turn on now and hardly ever take away from us, except when we go to sleep.
So why, in this point in our history, would we be more bored than we've ever been before?
Because using the premises that I believe in from my discipline of developmental psychophysiology, as mankind continues to accrue experience, that is, the average man on the street knows a lot more about the world than previous generations have. And so that means that routine experience is going to be less interesting for us than, say, a routine experience was for people of yesteryear. So I think the average person of the present, of contemporary life, has to do a lot more, has to do a lot more motor activity, mental activity, in order to stay entertained compared to people of many years ago, hundreds of years, thousands of years ago.
This is kind of depressing, isn't it? I mean, you're saying there's this intense drive to keep ratcheting up experience, otherwise we're just going to be bored.
That's correct. See, but most people who think about this problem never even entertain the idea of habituation. There's two principles in psychophysiology that are well established. One is habituation, by which I mean that with repeated presentations of a stimulus, we gradually tune it out. We already know it. We don't have to pay attention to it. The other main principle is automatization of attention, by which I mean with repeated experience with anything, we gradually can do it on automatic pilot without even thinking about it. We gradually chunk together many bits and pieces of information that were new to begin with. And now, you know, after you've driven a car for a couple of years, you can do it, you know, in your sleep, and we often do. We get from one part of town to the other without even knowing that we, you know, without even remembering how we got there. And that's true for all skills, brushing your teeth, tying your shoes in the morning, putting on your clothes, all the things that we do millions of times, we do on automatic pilot. And my model is saying that we're doing more and more and more on automatic pilot, which means that more and more our intensity of consciousness is becoming lower and lower. And so as individuals and as societies or cultures, we have to continually ratchet up the intensity of our behavior by doing, you know, wilder and crazier and riskier things in order to stay entertained. And one of those vehicles for doing that is to have increasing conflagrations, conflicts, wars, games. Think of the popularity of games right now. What would we do without our sports? So we have a very fast pace of life now. You know, people are hurrying here and there, and they're answering their cell phones, blah, blah, blah. And that's considered to be stressful. But I think that's a mistaken notion. If we took away their cell phones and their capacity to fly to some strange foreign country and be a tourist, anything that changes the situation, The bigger stress for contemporary men would be information underload as opposed to information overload.
So boredom is actually a type of stress.
I'm suggesting that for modal contemporary Western men, it is the major stress, and that information overload, which is typically associated with anxiety or feeling overwhelmed, is more the problem of, say, a person who has very little development of cognitive structure, or a youngster, you know, who doesn't have the cognitive structure yet to filter out most of the world. So the brain is mainly a filter. It's a common misconception that the brain is a window. But contemporary neuroscience and my field of developmental psychophysiology sees the brain as a filter. The better built the brain, the better it is at filtering out anything new that comes in. It organizes it, tunes it out, doesn't have to pay attention to anymore. It knows it without having to pay close attention.
Well, I guess I'm trying to figure out whether you see this as a problem or not. I mean, you're describing this as kind of the inexorable march of history here, but is this something that we should be really worried about?
Yeah, I think there's a reason to be worried about it, because if my model has any merit, and I think it's still an open question, but in my book I think I've marshaled lots of evidence and perspectives on why it might be true. If it does have some merit to it, then the natural consequence of the continuing accrual of experience and knowledge and growing boredom is the ultimate entertainment, that is, you know, a world war in which everybody just fighting with each other for the thrill or the adrenaline rush of being killed. And I think we're already at that stage. And I don't think it's just limited to behavioral aggression. I think that many medical disorders or diseases are modulated to some extent by isolation from information or boredom for structures in nature. So that the disease puts you out of ease, it takes you out of your comfort level and introduces intensity of consciousness and gives you a sense of, oh, now I've got an enemy to fight against, which most of us need. You know, to think of the popularity of any kind of game. You know, you need someone to root against or fight against. Without the enemy, we feel flat. We don't feel like there's anything worth doing.
Well, I'm trying to figure out whether you think that we need to do something about this. I mean, if there's something problematic about always ratcheting up the intensity of experience, do we need to somehow try to change our culture to opt out of this heightening effect?
It's my prediction that if we don't do something about it, and I think we can do many things about it, if we don't do anything about it, then we're doomed to bore ourselves to death through, you know, planetary warlike behavior, which we blow ourselves up, basically, out of a sense of, oh, this is interesting, this is entertaining. That's where I think we're going.
Dr. Agustin de la Peña is one of America's leading authorities on boredom. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What do you think about boredom? Is it a big problem in our lives? How do you deal with boredom? We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, Doing Nothing, the history of loafers, loungers, slackers, and bums in America, as we conclude our hour on boredom. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Lutz is the author of Doing Nothing, a history of loafers, loungers, slackers, and bums in America. Lutz told Steve Paulson why he decided to do something about doing nothing.
It began when my son, Cody, at the age of 18, moved into my house from the East Coast, where he was living with his mother, and proceeded to lie on the couch kind of day in and day out doing nothing. Hence the title, Doing Nothing. And I was amazed at how angry it made me to see him lying there, even though I had spent an enormous amount of time doing nothing when I was exactly his age, spent time as a kind of wandering hippie numbskull around the country. So I really should have been able to understand that he was at a particular stage of life. And it literally made me angry. My body would flood with hormones and emotion. And I had not been an angry parent. I didn't want to be an angry parent. I had one of those, and I didn't want to repeat that mistake. And I'd been successful he has a couple of older sisters, for over 20 years. So it kind of shocked me, and I really started looking into the subject of doing nothing in order to understand my own odd emotional reaction to seeing him laying around watching TV, which obviously I'd seen him doing various times for 18 years already.
So instead of blowing up at him, you went off and wrote a book.
Yeah, I would go back downstairs to my study and kind of cool down, come back up and say, well, how's the resume coming along? His resume, of course, at that point was, I went to high school. There wasn't much more to add to it. And he would say, I'm working on it.
Now, there's a difference, though, between sitting on the couch watching TV day after day and traveling around the country, knocking around, you know, working as a short order cook, getting some manual labor jobs. I mean, that it may seem like doing nothing, but actually those are all life experiences. And really doing nothing. I mean, being a couch potato, I can see why that would get to you.
Yeah. Now, of course, I have this somewhat romanticized version of my own past that I can tell, in which I do a lot of, you know, I guess interesting things. I hop the freight trains and I travel around Europe and I do all sorts of things. But I also spend an enormous amount of time just, you know, smoking pot and laying in a hammock and doing absolutely nothing. So I there are two different ways to see my own story. Certainly my own father thought I was doing a whole lot of nothing.
Hmm. Now, is doing nothing the same as being bored?
No, and actually, you know, I am an expert at doing nothing, as I said, but I'm not really an expert on boredom. I studied people who claimed that doing nothing was the highest form of human activity, an ideal. And boredom, on the other hand, is most often people who have a sense that there's nothing to do, that there's nothing worth doing or nothing, certainly nothing to do at the moment. So on the one hand, you've got people who are bored because they're doing nothing and they don't like the fact that they're doing nothing. On the other hand, you have people who are doing nothing and they are proud of the fact that they're doing nothing. And those are the real classic slackers in Western history.
Now, why would some people say that doing nothing is the highest thing, the sort of the greatest goal in life?
Well, it's a rejection of the fundamental cultural values, most significantly the values placed on work. And it's often, of course, people who don't think that the work that they're being offered is worth doing. And so to do nothing is a form of resistance to wage slavery or boring, horrible jobs.
So basically the idea there is that to work, you're buying into the system and it's,
yes,
it's in essence the opposite of pleasure, the opposite of enjoying life.
Well, some people argue that you have to do nothing in order to enjoy life. I mean, either whether it's a kind of Zen version of it, a contemplative life version of it, or people who think that even our standard entertainments, you know, watching TV, watching Fanconi films, these things are ridiculous as well, and we don't want to do those. We want out of all of the current state of things.
Now, there's a long history of people who have written about doing nothing. And one of the ironies, of course, is that those people who often exalt doing nothing have been very busy getting the word out. I mean, often they're out writing books advocating the joys of doing nothing. But anyway, Herman Melville wrote a famous story, Bartleby the Scrivener, which to some degree touches on this subject, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Bartleby is working significantly on Wall Street. This is an 1853 story, 1853. And he starts off being a fairly good worker for a lawyer. He's a copier. He's basically a human Xerox machine. But then he just stops working, and his boss asks him to do something. He says, I'd prefer not to.
Bartleby, come in here and verify this notice of petition to administer an estate.
I'd prefer not to.
Bartleby, come in here and verify this notice of petition to administer an estate.
I would prefer not to.
Prefer not to? What do you mean, prefer not to? Here, take it and verify the notice.
I'd prefer not to.
Public records?
But it's part of your job. Are you refusing to do your job?
Excuse me, sir. Mr. Waxman.
It remains a mystery in the story. It's one of the great stories in American literary history, and partly because it's very, very hard to say exactly what it's about. But he stops working, and it's confusing to everyone around him, especially his boss, who just doesn't know quite how to deal with him. It's not outright rebellion. He never says, I refuse to. He says, I'd prefer not to. So it's an odd kind of passive resistance to the state of things.
So why does he stop doing his work?
Well, he eventually is such a slacker, Bartleby, that he stops eating as well, even though his boss, after he's thrown in debtor's prison and into the tombs, his boss tries to get him things to eat, and he simply refuses to, he prefers not to eat, and eventually dies from doing nothing. So from the perspective of Melville, perhaps this is a story of what happens when you drop out completely, a warning tale. But the boss, the lawyer who hires him, is a very kind of small-minded. He's brought to a certain kind of empathy by Bartleby, partly because he can't understand him. But the boss is certainly not who we want to be. As we read the story, we're more on Bartleby's side than we are on the boss's, but we can't be on either side, really.
And yet this is not exact. You wouldn't think this would be a prescription to be one of the great literary stories in American cultural history. I mean, it would seem to be the kind of this dead-end life of Bartleby. What gives it such legs?
We are a culture that's obsessed with work. Europeans make fun of us for always asking the first thing when we meet somebody, what's your name, number one, number two, what do you do? And Europeans find this, depending on their class, either ridiculous or de classe. Tocqueville noticed it immediately in the 1830s. We're a culture that has a very strong work ethic. When Max Weber writes about the Protestant work ethic, he finds the prime example of it in Benjamin Franklin. We're a country obsessed with work and therefore obsessed with not working at the same time. So Office Space, one of the great slacker movies, is about living in cubicles and entering reports into your computer all day long.
Corporate accounts payable. Nina speaking.
Hello, Peter. What's happening?
We have sort of a problem here.
Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that. I forgot.
Yeah. You see, we're putting the cover sheets on all TPS reports now before they go out. Did you see the memo about this?
Yeah. Yeah, I have the memo right here. I just forgot. But it's not shipping out till tomorrow, so there's no problem.
Yeah. If you could just go ahead and make sure you do that from now on, that would be great. And I'll go ahead and make sure you get another copy of that memo. Okay?
Yeah, no, I have the memo. I've got it. It's right.
Hello, Phil. What's happening?
Now, of course, if we ever had a perfect slacker or a perfect loafer or a perfect lounger, we don't know who they are, right? They're lost to history because they don't leave a trace. They really do nothing. If you really do nothing, nobody knows who you are. So the people we know, the people who have left a trace because they did some kind of work that made people sit up and take notice. So we have a select group of people who are doing nothing who are the famous slackers. And there are also, these images like Charlie Chaplin's Little Tramp, who are, just fictional characters. People love to consume images of the slackers. We love Peter in Office Space.
Looks like you've been missing a lot of work lately.
I wouldn't say I've been missing it, Bob.
Good one.
Oh, that's terrific, Peter.
Because we love these characters, people's authors sometimes represent themselves as that character, like Kerouac. Represent himself as a guy that's just wandering around the country doing nothing. But in fact, he was a very hardworking novelist. There's a kind of market value to representing yourself as a slacker.
What happens when you get to the 1980s? There was that movie, Slacker, that came mm-hmm. out. Is that redefining this idea in any particular way?
Well, yeah. I mean, the Linklater film is interesting because it really does rename this character for us, right? They are slackers from then until the present, partly because of that movie. And those characters are running around a bit too. They're walking around at least. They're bumping into each other on the street. And they're often very energetic in their discussion of, the Smurfs.
A friend of mine has this real weird theory about Smurfs, but, I've been thinking about it. I think it's kind of cool. Actually, I kind of like agree with it. It's like, he's talking about like Krishna. Like Smurfs are blue. And like he's saying that Smurfs are like getting kids like used to seeing blue people. And it's like, with Smurfs being blue, kids see blue people. They like relate to Smurfs, and they relate to blue people when Krishna comes about. And I don't know. I kind of agree with that.
There's this kind of constant activity and constant talking and constant moving around, but also a sense that whatever people are doing, they're doing it kind of to get by. So the woman who's selling Madonna's pap smear, she's really not fully engaged in pap smear sales. That's not her. That's not her reason for being on the earth. That's not why she. You know, that's not why she's just doing it just to turn the buck that she needs to get by, and people are willing to get by in fairly low financial burden ways.
Well, you also get the sense that there's not a clear dividing line between just being bored and being a slacker in the sense of objecting to wage slavery. I mean, the two, you're kind of both bored and you don't want to get a real job.
Yeah. Now, I mean, there isn't an enormous amount of boredom in that film, right? The people who are engaging with each other are whether it's about aliens who are amongst us or whatever their pet theory is, they're fairly energetic about the theory. And they want to do things like have a ritual for this guy to get over his breakup by throwing out everything related to his girlfriend. So they throw the typewriter that he wrote love poems off the bridge. You know, these kinds of whatever the issue is, they're not bored. They're engaged. They're just not engaged with anything that looks like work. They're not engaged in, they don't have careers. They don't have pension plans. They don't have savings accounts, but they're not exactly bored. Now in Office Space, Peter and his coworkers are kind of bored. And that's what kind of pushes him out of that work world. It's the boredom of his job is the problem, and figuring out, you know, kind of this blissful doing nothing that he's into in the middle of the film is his alternative to that boredom.
Is there anything to be said for boredom? Like, can that be a virtue?
Oh, yeah. I mean, boredom is exactly, like I say, boredom is what gets Peter out of his job finally, right? Boredom can be a great motivator. The person who's on the couch and has a fully developed slacker philosophy and says, I am doing nothing for the good of the planet. I'm going to leave as small a footprint as I can, and that means I'm not even going to move and burn up calories. You know, that kind of theory of why it's best to do nothing doesn't move anybody forward. But after being on the couch for a number of years, one might get bored enough to actually do something. That seems like a good thing if you don't believe that doing nothing is the highest human ideal.
Tom Lutz is the author of Doing Nothing, A History of Loafers, Loungers, Slackers, and Bums in America. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 24B, Boredom. The tedium is the message. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strangechamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.